This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Listening to LBC, let's go to the Pretoria courthouse. I think we're getting to the sentencing for Oscar Pistorius.
Both to society and to the accused. Count one. Culpable homicide. The sentence imposed is a maximum imprisonment of 5 years imposed in terms of section 276(1)(i) of the Criminal Procedure Act, number 51 of 1977. Two, on count two, the contravention of section 120, subsection 3b of the Firearms Control Act, number 60 of 2000. The sentence imposes 3 years imprisonment, wholly suspended for 5 years, on condition that within the period of suspension, the accused is not found guilty of a crime where there is negligence involving the use of a firearm. Paragraph 3, the sentence in count 1 and the sentence on count 3 shall run concurrently.
As the court pleases.
You may be seated, Mr. Pistorius. Is there anything I need to know before the court adjourns?
No, my lady. I indicated to the court that I would address the court on the accused being found unfit to possess a firearm. I've had a look at section 103 of the Act.
Yes.
Section 103 automatically, as soon as the accused is convicted.
Which act are we talking about?
The Arms and Ammunition Act. Section 103 of that Act.
Of which one?
The Arms and Ammunition Act.
That's 69. The 1969 Act?
60 of 2000.
60 of 2000?
Yeah, the latest Act.
Have I got the citation incorrectly?
All right, so that's breaking news from Pretoria then. The Oscar Pistorius on the charge of culpable homicide. We know it as manslaughter. The maximum term is defined by that particular definition. There are different types. So the judge going for one particular aspect of it. It's 5 years. So Oscar Pistorius jailed for 5 years. As regards the contravention of the Firearms Act, don't get too excited about that. 3 years, that's suspended for 5 years. They will run concurrently. So 5 years then for Oscar Pistorius. A little over an hour, that's summing up. Let's go now to Gary Alfonso, who's based in Pretoria, is outside the court. Gary, what are people saying?
Well, you could see some relief on the faces of the Steenkamp family in court when the judge gave that sentencing. It effectively means Oscar Pistorius will go to jail for 5 years, and with good behavior, he could be out in 2.5 years. And that's what the state wanted. The parents of Reeva Steenkamp looking as if they are happy with the sentence so far. I've not spoken to them outside the court yet, but still no word on whether the defense will now appeal this.
What happens now? What is the court process, Gary?
Well, the court process is pretty clear. He gets taken into custody and will be taken away to the prison authorities, where they will process him and within a day or two determine where he will go. Obviously, the defense has asked that he goes to a facility where his disability can be treated, and those have been identified, and already the prison authorities have given an indication of where he would go. So that's a simple forward-going process. It's just processing of court documents now. And if there is an appeal, then obviously an urgent application will be brought for a hearing, and then possibly a bail extension as this plea is then considered.
Thanks for that, Gary. Appreciate it. It's busy. I'll probably talk to you subsequently. One of my colleagues, Gary Alfonso, is a reporter based in Pretoria outside the courtroom. So 5 years for Oscar Pistorius. How has he gone from world-class athlete, gold medal winner, to convicted killer? LBC's Tom Sorbick looks at the background to the story.
And Oscar Pistorius, the greatest Paralympic athlete of all time, is going to take this gold medal.
Revered, celebrated, known the world over, a man overcoming tremendous physical disability to become the best.
Oscar Pistorius is the Paralympic champion of 2012.
The success, the career, the money, the celebrity and a beautiful girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, all seemed well. But the events of Valentine's Day 2013 changed that.
Breaking news out of South Africa. The double amputee sprinter Oscar Pistorius, who captured so many hearts at the London Olympics, has been charged with murdering his model girlfriend.
News just coming in. The South African police have charged Oscar Pistorius with murder. The Olympic athlete was arrested after his girlfriend was shot dead at his...
On March the 3rd, the charges were read to Pistorius. To all charges, the same plea.
How do you plead?
Not guilty, my lady.
On April the 7th, Oscar Pistorius took to the stand and began his evidence by apologising.
I'd like to apologise and say that there's not a moment, and there hasn't been a moment since this tragedy happened, that I haven't thought about your family. I can promise that when she went to bed that night, she felt loved.
He described to the court the moment he opened the bathroom door he had just shot through to find the blood-soaked body of his girlfriend.
She wasn't breathing.
He gave evidence for 7 days. His cross-examination at the hands of Harry Nell was, at times, brutal. The defence and prosecution finished their closing arguments on the 8th of August.
It's a state's case that the accused was a deceitful witness. The court should have no difficulty in rejecting his core version of events.
Consider that crucial point, taking into account 3 o'clock in the morning, knowledge of danger of people entering the house, standing with the firearm, should he have discharged the firearm, yes or no?
After months of evidence and argument, Judge Masipa finally delivered her verdict.
Mr. Pistorius, please stand up. The unanimous decision of this court is the following. He is found guilty of culpable homicide.
Today, Oscar Pistorius, the Olympic hero, the pin-up athlete, could walk from court ready to carry on his training for the Rio Games, or he could spend the next few years behind bars.
LBC's Tom Swarbrick, almost getting it right. It is the next few years, Tom. It's actually 5 years. Also, for the Contravention of a Firearms Act, 3 years, but that's suspended for 5 years, and that runs concurrently, waiting to hear of any form of appeal. Let's speak to Heather Walker, former editor of The South African, joins me now. Let's talk a little bit about the background and people that we've seen in this case. Hedy Nell, a prosecutor, emerges as a bit of a legal force here, Heather. That's fair to say, isn't it?
Yes, well, I think in the mitigation and stage of the trial, we saw that he had a lot stronger witnesses, and I think he did really well there to end up with the sentence that Pistorius got.
How divided are South African people about this? Was there a body of opinion, a degree of support for Pistorius?
Yes, certainly. I mean, there were those people who said that regardless of what he's done, he's still somebody who people looked up to and broke ground as an athlete. So I think there were certainly a number of people who stuck by him throughout the trial. And even, you know, as details emerged, what happened, they remained quite supportive of him and his family.
Can you give us an idea?
Obviously without...
Sorry, Heather. Yeah, indeed. Can you give us an idea of the esteem in which he's held by South Africans?
Well, before he came to the Olympics, he was already very well known in South Africa. He was probably one of our most well known and respected athletes. You know, he'd been seen to make huge strides, excuse the pun, for disabled sport around the world.
And how much were he and Reva Steenkamp, the girlfriend that he killed, how much were they seen as like a golden couple in the country?
Well, to be honest, I'd been living overseas for a couple of years, and I hadn't even really been aware that they were dating. I'd kind of, you know, noticed he'd been dating a few sort of model type of girls over the years, but hadn't paid close attention to it. It was only when the murder actually happened that, you know, I realized who this woman was. But I think within South African, you know, modeling and entertainment circles, she was fairly well known, and obviously her association with Oscar had brought her a lot more into the limelight.
You'll be aware, as the way the judge categorised the culpable homicide or manslaughter, as we call it in the UK, that determined the term. It could have been 15 years. Because of the grading, effectively, it's been given, and prosecuted wanted 10, he will do 5. It's worth saying the defence team asked for 3 years of correctional supervision. What's going to be the public reaction, do you think, in your former homeland?
Once again, I think it will be quite divided, but I think for most people, I think they'll feel that justice in some way is being done, and I really think the judge made a great summary of the various factors involved in her decision. You know, on one hand, mercy, and on the other hand, teaching society the consequences of your actions. So I think that most people will be fairly happy with the decision. I think a lot of people would have hoped for more, for a longer sentence. But the fact that he is actually being sentenced to time in jail as opposed to correctional supervision, I think will be seen as a good thing.
Heather Walker, former editor of the South African here in London now. Thank you for that. So, from gold medal winner to convicted killer. Remember, he fired 4 times through that bathroom door with his pistol. The idea that he thought there was going to be someone breaking into the house now completely and utterly discounted. We go back to 2013. That was when the killing was. So where are we now? Some 18 months on at last. South African justice, all the wheels have turned. 5 years in jail for that. You, many of you, will have followed this case. Some of it has been truly riveting. Harry Nell, the prosecutor, emerges, I would have thought, with a phenomenal reputation as a result. 5 years? Is that enough?
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
And it's Herbie in Harrow. Good morning.
Good morning, Nigel. Good morning, Nick.
Hello.
Nigel, what is this money for in the first instance? And what budget are the government going to take it from? The NHS, the police, education, infrastructure? Or can they take it from the HS2, which we don't require? And $1.7 billion is a lot of money.
It is. Well, Herbie, the first thing to point out to people is that our membership fee to the European Union currently runs at £55 million a day. Yes, that's right. £55 million a day is what we already pay into this club. Some will argue that we get nearly half of that money back, and that's true, but the money that comes back basically goes to pay rich landowners. You know, so the aristocracy are the biggest winners, actually, out of Britain's EU membership. So, but net or gross, we're paying in a vast amount of money, and here we are having to pay in a whole load more. The means by which our EU membership fee is calculated, they're very complicated, but one of the measures is the size of our economy, the gross domestic product. And what they've done is they've reallocated the size of our gross domestic product, believe it or not, by adding in what's known as the black economy. So they put a percentage on for the drugs trade, the vice trade, etc. No, honestly, I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you?
You must be very prolific at it, Mr. Farage. That's all I'm going to say.
Goodness only knows. I mean, I live a very innocent life,
indeed.
I'm sure. But, but of course, Herbie, you know, we also know that countries like France, frankly, are going down the tubes. So in relative terms, our, you know, the size of our economy is bigger, and therefore we have to pay 1.7 billion sterling, and we have but a few days to stump it up. Mr. Cameron, one of his great claims, if you remember, was that he'd cut the EU budget at a big summit, and he came out saying, we've cut the budget. But when we looked at it, although the overall budget had been cut, Britain's contribution had gone up, and I thought to myself then, well, Mr. Cameron, if this is a victory, I'd hate to see what a loss looks like. And now we've been hammered again. Where will the money come from? Well, I'll tell you, Herbie, where it'll come from. It will go on to our ever-growing deficit, because the elephant in the room of British politics that nobody wants to talk about is this coalition was formed, and they had a plan, and the plan was that by the end of the 5 years, they would have borrowing and spending at exactly the same level. They would not be...
Do you want me to laugh my head off this?
Well, I know. And actually, we saw some borrowing figures last week indicating that the situation's getting worse. And I tell you what's staggering, Herbie, then people don't, you really don't get this. By the end of this 5-year term, under George Osborne's chancellorship, our national debt which has been going since the time of Napoleon, will have increased by 40%. So that's how it's going to work. No doubt we'll hear some tough talk from Mr. Cameron today. He'll say he's going
to
battle
them. He's trying to get an alliance going with the Dutch Premier, isn't he, Nigel Farage?
Yeah, but he's not going to get any support from the Germans, and the Germans rule Europe. It is a German-dominated Europe, and what Mrs. Merkel says goes.
But if we've benefited, if Britain have benefited in the past from rebates, would it not be correct that this time, when we're doing rather well, we have to actually give more? If you look at 2012, I understand we got a rebate of £3.2 billion.
Well, yes.
So that's the rules of the game.
So therefore, our net contribution was still 8.6 billion sterling. That's over tuppence on income tax for everybody in this country.
But if we took it 2 years ago, because we weren't doing well, we took 3.2 billion 2 years ago. This year we are doing well. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with giving the 1.7 when you're doing well if you've been given 3.2 when you weren't doing so well?
Well, I tell you what, Nick, I've got a better idea than that. Why not pay nothing? Why not pay nothing? I'm quite happy to go on buying champagne or Mercedes motor cars or whatever it is we want to do, and we'll do business, and we'll go on holiday there, and we'll do student exchanges, and we'll be great mates, and that'll be wonderful. But what on earth do we have to pay a membership fee to a club who made 1,000 new laws for British businesses last year, and with whom we trade at a massive deficit? I wouldn't pay a penny. OK, let's move on to Elizabeth in Heathrow.
Oh, hello, Nigel. Hello, Nick. Delighted to be speaking to you. Okay, my question, statement first of all. In 2011, Jessie J, a white singer, she picked up 4 MOBO awards, which are Music of Black Origin, 2 of which was for Best Song and Video, Do It Like a Dude, a song which she sang in a fake Jamaican accent with lyrics such as, We Can Do It Like a Mandem Mandem, which translated is, we can do it like those men. Mm-hmm. Now, how does this compare with the complaints that the UK Calypso is racist and has caused offence because it's sung by a white man in a fake Caribbean accent?
Well, I remember the 10cc hit, I Don't Like Cricket. Great record, 1973, still played regularly on the radio. A lot of ska music, of course, were white people using sort of pseudo-Jamaican accents. I think even Madness might have had one of their hits where they, you know, were doing a black accent. Mike Reed has been in the radio industry probably even longer than Nick Ferrari. I mean, how about that? I know it doesn't seem possible, but there we
are. He's considerably more accomplished as well, I will say that.
But, you know, Mike Reed has been one of the top DJs in this country, Top of the Pops presenter and all the rest of it. A really all-round good guy involved in charity work. I like the man very much indeed. And he made this little Calypso song, and it was designed to be a bit of fun.
It was at Doncaster, wasn't it? Performed at your conference.
Absolutely right. He performed it after dinner. We all roared with laughter. He said, hey, how about we release this, have a bit of fun with it.
Did you authorise it, Mr. Farage?
I certainly didn't veto it. And I said, fine, Mike, if you want to do that, that's fine. And no problem at all. And so he released it on Monday, and I put it on my Twitter, and if people wanted to download it and pay for it, and then the profits would go to charity. I mean, you know, no problem with any of that. And I think Mike and I spoke to Mike the day before yesterday. Had he done this in any other context than UKIP, there wouldn't be a row at all. But because it's UKIP, people want to scream blue murder. And I tell you what gets me, Elizabeth. We've had more condemnation and outrage from left-wing commentators about Mike Reed's Calypso than we've had over the grooming and rape of thousands of young girls in the north of England. It shows a very, I think, twisted sense of priorities.
For those who haven't heard it, let's hear a little bit of it now, and you'll be interested, Nigel Farage, Nick Clegg's reaction yesterday. Mm. Mr. Clegg, can I have your view on this song?
Taxpayers' money, where does it go? Not even George Osborne knows. When we're in power and we engage, there'd be no tax on the minimum wage.
Now, that's former DJ Mike Reed. Who's withdrawn UKIP Calypso. So, Nigel Farage says it was a bit of fun. 160,000 people helped get it to number one. Now it's been deemed to be racist. It warns of illegal immigrants in every town.
Look, Mike Reed clearly doesn't like it anymore, so you don't have to ask my opinion. The actual person who sung it when I once hit the draw. I just kind of think, I don't know, I just think that's a white singer trying to sort of sing, you know, as if he's from a sort of different culture for a party that has just gone into bed in the European Parliament with a bunch of Holocaust deniers from Poland. I just don't think it's a great look. I really don't. And you know, I mean, it's just part and parcel of this this kind of image of UKIP, just not really. I mean, obviously they appeal to a significant number of people in the country, but I don't think they appeal to people who want this country to remain an open, generous-hearted, diverse place.
Thus spoke a member, a po-faced member of our current political class. No doubt, if we took Mr. Clegg's arguments there to their logical extension, we'd ban every impressionist, we'd get rid of every cartoon, of every satire, because everything we ever say or do could possibly cause offence to somebody. I think he's out of touch, and I honestly do not believe that that Calypso song of Mike's caused offence. I think it was confected outrage. That is my view. OK, we're going to move on now to Len in Harlow. Good morning.
Good morning, Nigel. Good morning, Nick.
Hello.
I'm probably one of the most British-minded people going. I don't even consider England a country, you know. And I think that the Scottish Government is just a glorified county council. And I'm getting really cheesed off with these people that are trying to get in. Well, they do get in from France and other places illegally, and they seem to get the soft glove treatment when they get over here. You know, keep them here, look after them, and all that. Why can't we get some sort of secured buses or coaches, keep them in a centre till we get a bus load and take them straight back?
Let's listen to Mr. Farage then.
Well, then, you know, you've got to ask yourself the question, why are all those people there in Calais? And I've seen it myself. There are thousands of them. Thousands of them trying to get to this country. Well, I'll tell you why. Because there is a very, very strong signal message that has been put out by our political leaders over the last few years. One of them, of course, is Nick Clegg, who was on this show yesterday, who just a few years ago was advocating amnesties for all illegal immigrants. And another LBC favourite, Boris Johnson, just 3 years ago, was advocating an amnesty for all illegal immigrants. Do you remember that Leslie Crowther game show, Come On Down? I mean, that's the message we're sending out. We're saying, look, come here illegally, don't worry about it, and when we catch you, we'll just say, ah, never mind, you can stay here. And that's the message, Len, we've been sending out. I know that these people are coming because they want to better their lives, and I understand that. But we've really come to a point where we don't know with a nearest million, maybe even 2 million, how many people are actually living in our country. We've got to start sending the right messages.
On that theme, Nigel Farage, this week it was revealed there are 12,250 foreign offenders in the UK. The British government has spent £850 million last year trying to manage them. They've increased the staff from 100 to more than 900, and there are nearly 60 what are called serious harm individuals roaming unchecked in this country. What's the solution?
We have two problems. One, of course, is the famous European human rights legislation, where there are... It took us 10 years to deport Abu Qatada. 10 years of going through constant appeals. But the other problem, of course, is the EU dimension. People were very shocked with the death of that 14-year-old girl, Holly, in West London. They were shocked, not just that she was killed, but they were shocked that the man...
Do you mean Alice Gross?
Gross, sorry.
Yes,
yeah.
Alice Gross, yes.
And people were very shocked that the police were chasing a Latvian man who had already served a murder sentence in his own country. Under European Union...
Who was subsequently found hanged, just to remind everybody.
Yes, he was, that's right.
Do go on, Mr. Farage.
That's right. And also, since he'd been in the country, had actually been arrested for further sexual assaults. And what shocked everybody was the fact that we are not allowed, under European Union rules, to stop foreign criminals coming into this country.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
In a recent YouGov poll, you came last of the four main leaders as to who the voters trusted. Why is this?
Look, I mean, polls, schmoles, they come and go every day. There are other polls which say completely different things. Look, clearly, as leader of a party which has never been in government before, has had to take incredibly difficult and downright unpopular decisions over the last 4.5 years to straighten out the terrible economic mess we inherited. Of course, some people who don't like that. There's some people, by the way, who absolutely abhorred the fact that we even went into coalition in the first place. I can't help the fact fact that some people want to sort of somehow claim that we can fix this unholy mess that was caused in 2008 without taking difficult decisions. The truth is we can't, and any politician, like Nigel Farage and others, who goes around saying, you know, I can solve all the problems of the world simply by blaming everything on foreigners, they're taking us for fools, and it might give them short-term popularity, but they're not actually, in my view, doing what's right for the country in the long run.
You feel very passionately about that, I can see. You weren't faking it at all there, Mr. Clegg.
Oh, the puns.
You never fake anything, then.
Sorry?
I'm just referring to your wife, Miriam González Durantes Clegg, who said recently, if you don't have it, you fake it. Women have been faking lots of things during history. If you're going to fake something, fake self-confidence.
Yeah, I think she was saying to girls, because, you know, Miriam helps run this campaign to inspire young girls to aim high, to think big, to dream big dreams about what they can do in the future. And she and a number of other women go into schools up and down the country.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And as part of that, what she was saying, and I think she put it very colourfully, and I think very memorably, clearly, she says, look, there are some girls who feel quite kind of frightened about something or intimidated by something. And so what Miriam was saying, well, look, you know, just put on a show of self-confidence.
Yeah,
because, you know, what she's saying is that sometimes girls will feel more kind of, will be more open about the fact that they're feeling nervous or anxious or apprehensive. And what she's saying, I think quite rightly, to
girls,
can
you tell when Miriam is faking?
Oh, for heaven's sake, stop. Nick, I'm not going to get drawn into this. I'm going to stick to what Miriam, and stop twisting what Miriam said. She was making a very, I think, actually a colourful, but very sensible kind of remark about how we've got to make sure that girls have got the kind of the oomph to show that they can really go for things which otherwise they might be sort of too nervous or apprehensive to aim for in the first place.
Should we get some more calls on the Prime Minister?
Why don't we do that?
Where should we go?
James in Cambridge.
Good morning.
Hello, James.
I'm a Canadian UK resident here, right. And my question to you is, how soon is the coalition going to deal with the tens of thousands of legal immigrants such as myself who are being punished by the 2014 Immigration Act?
Well, first, James, can I just, obviously, I think on behalf of everybody, just say to you and all other fellow Canadians how sorry I am to obviously have seen what happened in Ottawa yesterday. It sounds, you know, horrific.
Yeah, two days after another, of course, a person was killed as well.
Indeed.
They have troubles at the moment in Canada, I feel.
Indeed. But, you know, obviously, I think We all stand shoulder to shoulder with you in Canada because we cannot be intimidated by these people. James, tell me more, because you're obviously referring to a specific provision in recent legislation.
Yes, in the May 16th Immigration Act. It puts people like me with indefinite leave to remain. We need now to have a document in our passports in order to apply for jobs, to apply for housing. And we find that we're snookered because it takes between 4 and 5 months to get this document, and no employer is allowed to hire us until we have this document. So we have to sit around unemployed for 4 or 5 months, going deeper into debt.
Right.
When we are able-bodied, we are equally cannot apply for job seekers allowance or any benefit of the national insurance. In my case, I've paid for 34 years.
You lived here for 34 years.
Snookered by this legislation.
Right. James, to be honest, I'm not aware of the precise provisions of the document that you require whilst being on indefinite leave remain to seek work. So, and the delays that you've said to me now occurring getting that document in the first place. So, can I get your details from LBC?
Yes, of course.
And then I'll find out from the Home Office and get back to you. Is that okay?
Okay. Stay on the line, James. Someone will come and talk to you. Let's feed another email into the conversation if you can. Edna in Leicester, your election strategist, Ryan Coutts, he was indiscreet with his papers this week when he showed what's going to be in your election manifesto. Is he still fit for purpose?
Well, listen, of course we're having discussions about what's going on in manifesto, which are not finalised yet. Finalised yet. But if I understand it correctly, the bit of paper, apparently, which some photographer snapped, surprise, surprise, said that what we want is a Britain where we have both a stronger economy and a fairer society, because that's the way that we think you can spread opportunity. There's no secret about that, because that is something I've been saying repetitively and will say so every day between now and the generation.
Language tests for foreign workers, that was a bit of a slip, wasn't it, for that to come out?
Well, that's a policy that we've had for some time. We think that people taking...
It was clumsy, wasn't it?
Well, it's not a secret. I mean, it's hardly a secret what our policies are. It's hardly a secret that, for me, mental health is really important. It's hardly a secret I want fair taxes, and we've taken...
So you're totally relaxed with him wandering around, waving bits of paper at photographers.
I don't think people... It's, what's so funny about this, by the way, is if I gave you that piece of paper, look, I'm really proud of this thing, you wouldn't take any notice of it. No one write about it.
How dare you?
The fact that it's been snapped is confidential. Do you know what? From now on, I'm going to put top secret in big red letters.
I'd like that.
On everything I carry around. It's the way to get publicity.
I would like
for that. For our existing policies. Policies which, by the way, we've been going on about for months. So,
and policies such as paternity leave. Now, this is a new one, isn't it? For civil servants, paternity leave. What's this idea?
So the idea behind this is a very simple one, is that we've made it interchangeable for mums and dads to take off this block of parental leave, and they can, you know, if the mum decides to go back to work earlier, the dad can take the time off. It's a good thing for employers, because it means that, you know, women who are in the middle of a project or a senior in a position or want to get back to work can do so. So it's good for the economy, it's good for businesses. I mean... It's been extraordinarily sort of criticised. I mean, I know the sort of grumpy, rather sort of joyless folk at the Daily Mail don't like much anything that I sort of say or do, but they have come up with it. Byzantine sort of weird view that this is a costly thing to do. It doesn't cost anyone anything extra to give the parental leave entitlement you're giving to a woman to the man instead, because it means the woman's back at work and the man is not. And,
nightmare to administer.
No, it's not at all. It's not at all. The suggestion. I mean,
What's wrong with just having a cigar, celebrating the baby, and going back to work?
It is so anti-women for these miserable folk at the Daily Mail to say that somehow a woman being paid to take parental leave is okay, but a man being paid to give parental leave is not. I mean, they really... Can I just genuinely and gently and politely ask these folk to just move with the times? There are so many parents now...
I have to say, they probably have more readers than you have voters.
Well, I'm not entirely sure about that, but anyway... I'll tell you what, I do think there are lots of particularly younger couples now.
You don't think they represent quite a sizable chunk of this country? You think, oh dear God, this is just too difficult to put through. Never mind the cost. I hear what you say about the cost, but just the whole dad's got to have as much time off as mum.
No, but don't misrepresent it. It's not dad takes as much time. It's really important. Don't sneer. It's a very simple idea that mums and dads shouldn't be told by a bossy government about how they take time off when they have children. It should be for them to decide.
How many companies have you run where you've had to manage this sort of thing?
This is something we're introducing into the civil service.
Yes, I hear that.
And I've actually spoken to many employers.
How many companies have you run where you've had to administer all this?
I've spoken to many employers who say they really, really welcome this.
Yes. Okay. How many companies have you run where you've had to administer?
It's not relevant. Ask the employers themselves. Ask the employers.
Of course, the employers. Yeah. Yes, of course, that's ridiculous. That's like asking children if they've done one homework. What are they going
to say? The employers, the bosses, the companies. Ask them. And do you know what they say?
What, they'll say
yes, a lot of them do. But do you know why?
Sorry, I misheard you. Yeah, go on.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because they say that they've got women in their workforce who they want to keep, who they want to make sure that where they can, where they've got arrangements with their partners, with their husbands, with the
dad. How much leave did you take when you had your three sons?
Actually, as it happens, I took different leave, because my third boy, when he was born, I was already leader of the Liberal Democrats. I didn't have much time. I didn't take much leave at all. My first boy, at that point, actually, as it happens, Miriam was working very hard. I took more time off. She went back to work much more quickly than she did.
So you sort of brought up baby for the first.
But the point is this, is that Miriam and myself don't want to be told, which is apparently the view of these rather grumpy characters in the Daily Mail and elsewhere. They don't want to be told by big government what choices to take for themselves. And I'm an old-fashioned liberal who believes that in this day and age, many, many couples, particularly younger couples, want to take their own decisions about how to take time off. It doesn't cost people anything more, because if the dad takes time off, the mum is back at work. And I'd like to see more women back at work, and not this sneering view that somehow says that a mum back at work is less sort of worthwhile than a dad back at work.
We move to other...
Debbie in Sutton.
Oh, good morning. I'm a dental hygienist in Sutton, in Surrey. Hiya. I'd like to discuss the UK failing dental hygiene system that we've got for children.
Right.
In my time in practice, obviously, I'm seeing more and more poor hygiene for children and a higher caries rate. So 7 years ago, I set up a scheme called Toothy Pegs, which is a school and practice-based dental education program.
Toothy pegs.
Yeah, right. We use characters to as oral health educators for the children. They listen to them. They love it.
I've got to move you to your question, Debbie. I'm desperately sure we haven't got that much longer. If I can sort of move you to that now, thank you so much.
My question is basically, why would you consider an idea like Tooty Pegs to be something that the government could provide for our kids with parents, teachers and the dental health profession all working together?
And this, of course, comes after NICE has suggested that school teachers should actually help teach children to brush their teeth. I don't know if you heard that this week.
Yeah, I did. I mean, well, look, Debbie, you'll know better than I do. I mean, well, of course you know better than I do. The state of the sort of dental hygiene for little kids is pretty shocking in some places. And whilst there are lots and lots of parents who, you know, diligently make sure that their little boys and little girls, their sons and daughters, brush their teeth morning and evening, I'm afraid it does seem to be the case that there are a lot of kids who turn up at school and teachers can see that, you know, they're eating badly or their dental hygiene is not up to scratch at all. I don't know about your Toothy Pegs scheme, Debbie, but I want to congratulate you for doing it, because you've obviously taken matters into your own hands. You care about it massively, and if I can, I'll look into it. But by the way, I should say, Debbie, I'm actually quite interested in your view. Do you think having a healthy meal at lunchtime for little children is a good thing for their teeth or not? Because it's one of the kind of side benefits to something that we've introduced as of last month, which is that the little children in the first 3 years at school get a proper healthy meal at lunchtime.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
And the idea that all women aged 35 or over should have their fertility checked and be told they ought to freeze their eggs if they hope to conceive. So says one of Britain's leading IVF specialists. Paul Sahal, who's founder of the Centre for Reproductive and Genetic Health, says too few GPs are up to date with current practice and give patients poor advice. A test has been developed that gives women a traffic light readout of their fertility. Oh, dear, dear, dear. Green is fine. Amber shows a depletion in eggs, and red is the news that conception is going to be particularly problematic. It measures the number of eggs left and their ability to implant in the womb. Mr. Sahal says many doctors are unaware of the test or advise that eggs are frozen only when women are given a red light. By that time, he says, I think it's already too late. It's going to take a generation for this to filter through to medical doctors. In my opinion, all women who are 35 and over should be offered a test and told what their chance of conception should be. As you've probably worked out, I'm not a woman, but I never knew that any woman can go in. I find that extraordinary that I didn't know that. The centre's been running since 1990. It comes on the back of the news last week. Apple and Facebook offered to pay for their female employees to freeze their eggs. They face considerable criticism for suggesting that women might want to put motherhood on hold while they built their careers. The firms say they hope the schemes will help them attract more female staff and retain them for longer by alleviating pressure on women to have children before a particular age. Others say women should have children when they're still relatively young, rather than delaying them to fit around their work. Some commentators point to the fact and say that that is nature's way. Ladies, would you want to take that test? More importantly, would you want to freeze your eggs? Let's speak with Yakub Khalaf, who's director of the Assisted Conception Unit at Guy's Hospital, joins me now. What's your view on this practice and whether it should be widespread? Good morning.
Good morning. I think testing women's fertility is something that probably is born out of the infertile patients that we see. But in the general population, let's not forget that most women who would like to have a child, they have it with ease and we don't know anything about them. Infertility only affects 1 in 7 or 1 in 6. So the majority are not really the ones that come to us. But when it comes to assessing fertility, for those who are trying for a baby, it is helpful because then it will give us a handle on the prognosis, their chances of having a baby. But if we move on to the idea that women should consider freezing their eggs if they are contemplating a pregnancy beyond the age of 35, I think that is not a reasonable consideration.
Without becoming too graphic, because it's half-term and there are children listening, but how easy is it to harvest eggs, Mr. Khalaf?
It is not. The technical side is not the most difficult. It is just a personal decision to embark on a treatment that involves taking drugs, hormones, and monitoring, and then having a needle stuck in the ovaries under sedation, and then the eggs are harvested.
I see.
And usually on average about 12 or 15 eggs can be harvested at one go.
I see. And then they need to be professionally frozen or maintained, don't they?
Yes.
Right. So there's a cost attached to that. Does the patient bear that cost? Does the NHS pay that cost? How does that work?
I don't think the NHS bears that cost for women who are freezing it to ensure that they can have a child later in life. However, if a woman is having cancer treatment that could affect her ability to reproduce later, the NHS generally would cover preserving fertility.
Okay. So, lastly, what's your view on these companies you might have heard of last week, Apple and Facebook, who are offered to pay for their female employees to go through this process?
I think it's a very intelligent idea on their part, because women who are having careers and they don't have the right circumstances to start a family early in life might benefit from this initiative, and they don't find themselves facing difficulty when they start trying for a family when they are 38, 39.
Fascinating background. Yaqub Khalaf is director of the Assisted Conception Unit at Guy's Hospital. Let's speak with Jessica Hepburn, who's written The Pursuit of Motherhood. And I understand... Can I call you Jessica? Is that right?
Yes, of course. Of course.
Jessica, you've spent a considerable sum on IVF.
I have, yes, yeah.
How much?
Nearly £70,000 over a period of nearly a decade,
right.
And 11 rounds of IVF, which is at the extreme end of the spectrum, I'm aware.
Have you enjoyed success?
No, sadly, not yet. Sorry. I mean, we're still on our journey. But yes, but I mean...
Would you mind if I ask? You don't have to answer it. Would you mind if I ask your age?
Yeah, I'm 43 now. So
why is it so important to you, Jessica?
I think for many women, I heard this wonderful interview with Oprah Winfrey last week and the writer Elizabeth Gilbert that says that there are three types of women. There are women that want to be mothers, there are women that want to be aunties, and there are women that shouldn't be allowed 10 feet within a child. And it doesn't matter which woman you are, but if you are the woman that wants to be a mother, then having that denied to you is one of the most painful things that you can go through, and particularly in a society where you know, we believe that this is something that's a given, being a parent. So this is why, you know, so many women, myself included, go to such extremes to achieve this thing.
Would you have had your eggs frozen?
I think I might have done, but what I really do want to say, through long experience and sort of really in-depth understanding of this subject as a patient, is that it's absolutely essential not to see freezing your eggs as an insurance policy for having children later in life.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the thing is that, you know, and this is something that's not talked about. I mean, obviously, IVF is a modern miracle, and many people achieve their dreams to be a mother through it. However, two-thirds of IVF successful cycles are unsuccessful. Two-thirds are unsuccessful. So, therefore, it is no guarantee that if you freeze your eggs, even younger eggs in your 20s, that when they're unfrozen, that they are going to make a baby. And also, there is very, very little evidence at the moment, and in fact, there has been very little done to show that it is successful. There's only a few thousand, I think, babies that have been born through egg freezing. That's mainly women who are younger, and often because they've had them frozen because of cancer treatment.
I will leave it there. Jessica Hepburn, thank you. You've written The Pursuit of Motherhood, and you spend a considerable sum on those. I wish you nothing but success with that. Now, coming out to you, would you have your eggs frozen? All women aged 35 and over, if they hope to conceive, should be doing that. You should take these tests as well. Let's speak to, it's not her real name, we're going to call her Amy in Yorkshire. What happened to you, Amy? Good morning.
Hello. Well, I read about this in a newspaper years ago, actually, and decided to investigate it, and found a place in Sheffield that did it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was 39 at the time, and I thought, well, you know, it might be an idea to have a backup plan, because I hadn't found the right person. So I went and had the test. It was relatively, you know, straightforward.
So they had the coloured lights and everything like that, huh?
I don't really remember. I just remember, you know, it wasn't as horrible as I thought it would be.
Right. Okay.
You know, and they said, yeah, you know, you've got a good level of eggs. Actually, you're quite fertile for your age, and that's a good thing. And if I remember in terms of costs, I haven't looked at it in years, but the cost, for some reason, the figure of 3,000 is in my mind. I can't remember if that's the figure to freeze it the first time, and then it's another 3,000, because you can freeze it, I think, for 3 years, and then you can freeze them again.
Right.
Or if that was 1,500 first.
That covers the harvesting and storage or whatever. Horrible words.
Yeah, I can't remember whether it was 3,000 and 3,000 or whether it was 1,500 and 1,500. You know what I mean? Because I haven't looked at it in years, but the figure of 3,000 sticks in my mind. And in the end, I didn't do it because I was having some job uncertainty, and I thought, well, I can't really afford to shell out that kind of money, especially because I was going to be moving as well. Mm. And I thought, well, then my eggs are going to be somewhere where I'm not. Interestingly enough, I have been thinking that maybe I might want to look at it again, even though now I'm, 42. But I figured I was pretty fertile then, so maybe I'm not so bad. Because one of the things that I learned when I looked into it is actually your fertility lasts a lot longer than potentially. I mean, if you're, you could be one of the lucky ones that it could last longer than the people have you think.
Yes, yes. Presumably, though, each year over 40... Amy, I know it's not your name, but each year you're over 40, it's going to decline more markedly. Do you see what I'm saying?
No, that's true. No, absolutely that's true. But it's not quite the... I guess what I took out of it when I looked at it, yes, it declines, but it's not like you go off a cliff. A lot of people talk about you're ticking time bomb, the biological clock ticking, and I don't know, I always had this impression that, after you're 40, it's basically game over.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not quite that black. Yes, okay, it's better off if you do it earlier, which is why, again, they recommend that, if you can freeze your eggs before 40, it's a lot better. That was actually in their literature,
sure,
they said.
Sure,
And
so what are you going to do?
It's on my to-do list to actually dig up the stuff and find out if there's some place now where I'm living that does it. Mm. And I also want to do a bit more research, because part of the other reason that I thought about it is actually, okay, they say they can do this, but really, what's this, I need to do a bit more. Does it really, really work? Do you see what I mean? Because you're doing this thing and you're freezing it.
Mm.
How is it? And also, the other thing I want to look at is, what are the quality of the eggs like after 40? I don't want to inflict... a lot of problems on a child. See what I mean?
I see exactly what you mean. Amy, whatever your name is, good luck. I hope it works out. Hope perhaps the right person comes along as well, which will take care perhaps of some of your concerns.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. Leading Britain's conversation, Larry Lamb on LBC.
Trying to get a new start when you serve time in prison is not easy. Seemingly, a lot of potential employers are very wary of employing ex-offenders. How can they be encouraged to think differently?
My fiancé is a reformed criminal. I do think people absolutely deserve a second chance. I think, if anything, my partner values the life he has now so much and works so hard to make sure that nothing jeopardises that.
That's it. Staying on the straight and narrow, right?
Definitely.
The one and only Larry Lamb. Sunday morning from 11, only on LBC. This is LBC. On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
The 6 o'clock.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Continuing the musical theme, La Traviata. Tremendous piece indeed. Well, not for one Muslim woman wearing a veil covering her face, who was told to leave a Paris opera house. The woman is known to be a tourist from a Gulf state, was ordered out after members of the cast refused to perform if she remained in the audience. That's right. So security guards asked the lady to leave, and she duly did. Now there's a bit of a row going on over in France, or particularly in Paris. Some people are saying that the rich tradition of French culture should have been far more accommodating. Others are saying, well, it is the law. Get your views on this in just a second. Briefly, while I totally agree that if you're in a courtroom, if you're a teacher, possibly even if you're going into a bank or building society, if they still exist, you probably shouldn't wear that full covering. sitting in an opera house? What is the problem? What's the legal aspect of this? Let's speak with Benedict Bavio, who's UK correspondent for France 24. And they are, in fairness to the opera house, they are following the letter of the law. Benedict, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, they are, because France banned the wearing of the full face veil or niqab in public spaces in 2011. And let's remember that this ban was indeed upheld by the European Court of Human Rights earlier this year. You worded it in an interesting way. You said ordered her out. They didn't. My understanding of this incident that actually happened, or this occurrence that happened on the 3rd of October during this performance of La Traviata, but actually came to light officially, publicly on Monday, is that actually somebody approached her, somebody from the Paris Opera House approached her discreetly and knowing that they were tourists and they may not be aware of the law, made her and the man who was with her aware of the law and invited her either to take off her face veil or said that actually
I
they
don't
would
know
need
the
to
French
leave, whereupon
for
the
semantic.
Man actually then actually... Oh, but these are important. Semantics in life, Nick, are very important.
Well, you might not call that... How else would you characterise that other than you were obliged to leave?
No, she was, my understanding and the way it's been told is that the head of the Paris Opera is saying that she was informed of what the law was in France and given two options, basically. One is either to uphold the law in order to, and so remove her face veil, or that she would be asked to leave, whereupon apparently the man who was with her said, ask her to leave with him. Apparently, interestingly, you might be interested to know, they didn't ask for a reimbursement.
Well, oh, that's interesting.
€467.
You see, because I've got that they were not given refunds, but then I don't know whether they are, or they chose not to ask, did they? What does this say about, what is it, liberty, fraternity and equality?
Well, it's
not a lot of
liberty and equality. Your freedom ends where somebody else's begins, and one must uphold the law. And indeed, as I said, that law was upheld by the European Court of Human Rights. So that's the law in France, not in Britain,
no?
But it's the law in France. And what the Paris Opera interestingly points out is the fact that many Muslims have come before and will come again to the Paris Opera House. But in this particular instance, it is a premiere, not on stage, but in the front row.
I appreciate, well, I don't know that you're an opera singer, you may be, but I doubt that you were taking part in this particular production. You might want to simply say, well, ask them. But what was the possible harm? What was the problem for the singers?
I don't think it's that it was a harm. I think the fact is that it's the law, and as I said, it's apparently a premiere. This hasn't happened before. So what apparently happened is that some people on stage noticed this, and apparently also on the camera screens, video screens. What I think is interesting is the fact that nobody thought, the attendants didn't think to, when they were checking their tickets.
Yeah, how she ever got in.
She got in. Yeah. So I think that that in itself is interesting.
Okay.
But it's simply upholding the law as it is in France.
And as you rightly point out, that law has been, as you rightly say, supported by that appeal. Thank you, Benedict Pavio, UK correspondent for France 24. Not a lot of compassion coming from that contributor. Azam Tamami is from the Muslim Association of Britain. What are your reaction to what's happened across the channel? Good morning.
Good morning, it's Tamimi.
I'm so sorry, sir, Tamimi. Okay. I'm so sorry. What?
I couldn't but laugh, actually, at this story. It's an amusing story. The French decided to ban the niqab, but this is a visitor. This is someone who came from outside. Probably she didn't know about the law. I cannot tell whether she knew or not. And I think it's very discourteous of the French not to be able to deal with the visitors, tourists who come from outside. I personally don't agree with the niqab. I don't think it's binding in Islam. My wife doesn't wear it.
No.
But in some cultures, this is an acceptable norm. And if the French want to close their doors to tourists who uphold these norms, then bad luck for the French.
I tell you what, Mr. Tamimi, we must celebrate the fact that we live in a country where, if you so desire, you can go to the theatre or the cinema or walk down the street wearing a headscarf. That's something that we can give praise for, I would suggest.
Oh, definitely. I'm delighted I live in the UK and not in France. I know that, and I have friends who live in various parts of Europe, and I know that in the UK we have the best relatively speaking, that is, comparatively speaking,
yes,
we have the highest degree of respect for individual freedoms.
Yeah, I agree with that. Apologies for mangling your name. Azam Tamimi is from the Muslim Association of Britain. Thank you for your input. Shirley's in Beckenham. This is absolutely ridiculous.
Hello, yes. Good morning. I get really hot under the collar about this whole business of women covering themselves, particularly with the veil.
Why?
But I just find it actually objectionable. I mean, it is a way that
I think it all stems from medieval times.
Madam, when most Islamic people were living in tents in the desert.
Shirley.
May I continue, please?
Well, you don't
and
have to wear one.
They were, if somebody had a beautiful wife, they were afraid that if they didn't cover themselves when they went outside, somebody else would carry them off. I think it's basically it goes right back to that.
No
but
one's
in
asking...
modern times, why should they have to cover themselves?
Because maybe she chooses to.
No, but why does she choose?
Well, that's her
why
choice.
Why does she choose? That's the question.
But that's her choice.
No, but... You don't understand. It's a sign of women being treated as subservient people. I just don't like it. Why should they... I mean, in some places, women aren't allowed to go out by themselves unless they're accompanied by a male relative and
well,
all that sort
hang
of thing.
On. We don't
I
know
just
that
think
anything
wrong.
Was, we don't know that any of that was going on with this couple.
Well, I'm saying it goes on in this country, and I just think it's completely wrong.
So you agree with the
to
singers?
See people walking around... In England,
you agree with the
covered.
Cast. You agree.
Sorry?
You agree with the cast who said they wouldn't continue the second half unless she.
Yes,
because
there it's part of the law.
All right, let's see if others agree with you. I listen. If a woman wants to wear it, absolutely fine. Unless you can prove she's, of course, the victim of some form of harassment or abuse from her husband. That don't seem to be it in this case. Meanwhile, let's talk to Hash at Heathrow about this veil in Paris. What would you have done?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have been offended myself.
No.
Personally. I mean, I'm a Muslim.
Right.
But I believe that if I have a guest in my house, it's my choice to who I let in and who I don't. So the opera house has a right to let in and to let out whoever it doesn't agree with. So I don't see why it's a big issue if they don't want particular people, if they don't want someone to be there, then that's their choice. It's their own place, so...
Yeah.
It should be their choice as to who is in and who's not.
Wrong, though, isn't it?
Right or wrong is besides the point. I mean, if it's my
it's not beside the point.
Like
that's why we're debating it. I say again, I can see in financial institutions and courtrooms and things such as that, but an opera house, what the heck do they think is going to happen?
They may not like it. They may not agree with some traditions, with some religious beliefs, so... It's their choice.
Hash, thank you. Michael's in Acton. What do you say, Michael?
Morning, Nick. Well, I'll give you an example. If you go to Saudi Arabia as an unmarried couple, walk hand in hand down the street, they're liable for arrest. If you go to Morocco as a gay man and the authorities find out, as we all know, you're liable to arrest. These are the laws.
Hang on. Whoa. The Morocco... I've never been to Saudi Arabia. I don't believe that if you're seen holding someone's hand, you're going to be arrested. In the Morocco case, they believed he was with an underage lover. Wrongly. They wrongly thought.
Let me assure you, right, that in Saudi Arabia, if you're unmarried, okay, and you're caught kissing or hand in hand, you're liable for arrest. There's nothing wrong with that. That's their laws, which is fine. Mm-hmm. You respect other people's laws when you travel to their countries. Quite rightly, the French have brought this law in, okay? People come in from there...
Why is it right?
Because it's right because, obviously, there was a demand for it. Didn't one of those London bombing terrorists escape the country dressed in a burqa?
It is believed. Yes, he did, yes.
Yeah. So you can quite understand people's fears and, you know, good luck to the French.
How can you be frightened of a bit of cloth?
Because you don't know what's under the cloth.
So as I've said, in banks, in courtrooms, possibly even passport control. But sitting in an opera house?
How many people go to an opera? How many thousands of people can be held in an opera?
2,500, 3,500, I'm guessing, roughly.
There you go.
I don't understand.
Someone had bad intentions.
Well, you mean a bomber? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, for example.
Right, so...
It's been done before.
Right, so you think that Al-Qaeda or ISIL or whatever are planning for people dressed as female opera fans to blow up an opera house?
What I'm saying is this, you know, if you go back a couple of years when a terror plot was unveiled to blow people up at a football stadium and a nightclub, why wouldn't a, you know, a high-profile French opera be a target? You just don't know.
So you agree with what the singers and indeed the Opera House did then, lastly, Michael?
Absolutely right. I think they did the right thing, and it's their law, and good luck to them.
Thank you for that. Tamina's in Stratford. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree, because I think sometimes... I'm a Muslim woman. I don't wear a headscarf, but I think sometimes we forget that regardless of what a woman is wearing on her head or anywhere on her body, she still has aspirations. I know many Muslim women who are successful doctors, lawyers, dentists. I mean, even 14-year-old girls that I know in Bradford, that's where I'm from originally, who wear a headscarf out of choice, and they have aspirations to become lawyers, teachers, even social activists.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, Larry Lamb on LBC.
Trying to get a new start when you serve time in prison is not easy. Seemingly, a lot of potential employers are very wary of employing ex-offenders. How can they be encouraged to think differently?
My fiancé is a reformed criminal. I do think people absolutely deserve a second chance. I think, if anything, my partner values the life he has now so much and works so hard to make sure that nothing jeopardises that.
That's it. Staying on the straight and narrow, right?
Definitely.
The one and only Larry Lamb. Sunday morning from 11, only on LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Rachel in Chesant. Hello, Rachel.
Hiya.
Hello.
I'm just wondering what your opinion is on the cancellation of the performance in Paris regarding the women in the audience wearing the veil. You know, I personally believe that they were right. It's not a case of having an offence to people wearing a headscarf, and, you know, it's their religion and it's their beliefs. But I do find it...
Rachel, I'm really sorry. I don't know what performance you're talking about.
Let me just remind listeners. This was earlier this month, Rachel. It was a performance of La Traviata at the Paris Opera House. And during the interval, members of the cast made it plain there was a woman wearing the full Islamic headdress quite near the front of the audience. I have to remind everybody, of course, it is illegal to do that in France. And the cast said they would not carry on with the show unless the woman left. She was offered the opportunity by the staff at the Opera House to either take it off or leave, and she and her male companion chose to leave.
She was just in the audience.
She was just in the audience, yeah. She was just
and
in the
audience. And the performer said they wouldn't perform.
The performer said there'll be no second half unless she either takes it off or she goes. And
this is just my knee-jerk response, because sorry, I missed this. It's the first time I've heard of it. I think that's ridiculous. I really, really do. She's just in the audience. What are you going to say next? That someone's in the audience and they've got tattoos that the cast don't like, or...
No, not at all. It's a case of, in France, it's illegal. For two, you wouldn't go to a doctor with them wearing a veil.
Oh, that's different.
You wouldn't go to this. Well, no, not really. You're a performer. You should be able to see
No, I disagree with that, Rachel. The line's not great, Rachel.
We'll keep you on, but let's hear from Mr. Clay.
We've actually talked about this before. Where I agree is, look, someone... I don't, for instance, think it's right for girls or women to wear the full veil in a classroom or in a college, because I think teachers do need to, of course, make contact with, you know, facial contact with the people. I don't think the full veil should be worn when there's security checks where you need to be able to identify the face of somebody. Of course, there are circumstances. In a courtroom, I think it's quite right that people should be... You should be able to see what witnesses and so on are saying. You should be able to see their face. In the audience, in a performance, I mean, my recollection every time I'm on a stage is the lights are so bright you can barely see the audience anyway. I don't think they're...
Well, she was sitting in the front, so they could see her. And not, as a performer, I think you'd be quite disappointed if the first row was asleep.
But Rachel, what if someone's wearing a hat? Wearing a hat in the audience and you can't...
Mr. Clay, it is illegal to wear the full veil in France.
In France, I know, but it's not here.
This was in Paris.
Oh, yeah, listen, French law is French law. It's not
So you're actually condoning this woman breaking the law?
I do not want this country to become like France, where you start prescribing by law what people can wear. You know, we live in quite a different country to France.
Part of me agrees with you, but part of me doesn't. I mean, at the end of the day, we're not talking about... we're not talking about taking away the headscarf per se. We're talking about the fact of covering the face. You know,
Rachel, where you and I agree is there are circumstances where it's quite right to say to people, whatever your faith, whatever your community you come from, look, we've got to be able to see your face. And as I say, in security checks, courtrooms, classrooms, and so on. That's absolutely right. This is a woman, if I understand it correctly, would have paid, you know, good money to go and see an opera. For all I know, she might be a great opera buff. She's sitting there minding her own business, watching a performance quietly. I understand it's the French law, and I'm not, you know, I don't. The last thing I want is French politicians to start declaring on British law. I'm just saying, as a British politician, as a British person, I like the fact that we're different to France and we don't have laws of the land pointing a long finger of the state saying, thou shalt wear this or thou shalt not wear that. I just don't think that's the kind of country, the free country we are. And it's what sets us apart from France.
Rachel, thank you. Shall we move on?
Sam in Ilford. Hello, Sam.
Yes, good morning, Nick.
Morning.
Last week you were spouting on about Ched Evans being a role model for youngsters.
Right.
What's the difference between Ched Evans being a role model and MPs being a role model?
I agree with you that people in public life are role models. I wasn't trying to spout on, Sam. I was just trying to, comment, not least as a Sheffield MP, where a lot of people in, you know, my neck of the woods in Sheffield, I'm back up there this afternoon, are talking about this a lot.
What are they saying in Sheffield, Mr. Clay?
Oh, I think opinion's divided.
Is it? Yeah,
I think opinion's really quite divided. I mean, it's one of those things.
He was a key player, wasn't he? I understand.
Yeah. A very good one. There's opinions divided. There aren't that many people who are saying somehow, you know, politicians or the government should sort of step in on this. I think everybody accepts it's for the football club to decide.
Mm.
And it's a tricky one, you know. There are some people who are saying, look, he's done his time, he should be able to play. There are people like me who say, well, I'm assuming the football club will want to think twice just because, as Sam has said, you know, Ched Evans isn't just a footballer. He's a, you know, people like that are also role models. And
But so are MPs. And why were all the MPs that fiddled their expenses allowed to return to their job as an MP then?
Well, of course, a lot of them were not.
Ched Evans as a role model, surely these MPs should have also been struck as their MPs.
Yeah, yeah, no. And a lot of them, well, some of them, of course, ended up in prison. Some of them ended up in court. A lot of them didn't stand again at all. We're actually at the moment, discussing in Parliament how to make sure that when MPs in future commit serious wrongdoing, you as a voter don't have to wait until the next general election to cast your judgment, that you can push for an MP to be sacked between elections. So of course people need to be held to account. Look, I'm slightly reluctant to kind of give a running commentary on the fact that someone's been convicted here in Ched Evans's case of a serious offence, done his time in prison, and so on. I just, not least because a lot of people, where I'm an MP, sort of talking about this, a lot of football fans and other talking about it across the whole country. I just see yesterday he hasn't struck a single kind of word or note of remorse at all,
He apologises for his infidelity to his girlfriend, doesn't he? I don't know if you've seen his video.
No, I've heard about it, though, but you know, what about the victim? And this is a serious
offence.
Well,
he's appealing. He can't really, if you've got an appeal, it would be... I mean, the BBC, of course, have got in the middle of this now. They've had to apologise because one of their journalists, Michael Burke, said the victim had not emerged with any credit, as she was so drunk she could barely stand.
Well, what I've not done, and I'm not going to do, and I've never done, is to try and sort of second-guess the decisions of the court. The court took a decision. They said that he was guilty of a serious, very serious crime, and he's done time for it. And I don't think there's any point, any of us, trying to somehow second-guess all the details of the case or the circumstances in which the crime took place. But, you know, a court of law, that's the... We live in a country where the court, you know, what the courts decide... we have to abide by until it's proven otherwise.
We move on. Where do we go next?
Sheila in Leighton.
Hello?
Hello, Sheila.
Oh, yes. Hello, Nick. Two Nicks. Okay. Nick, Mr. Clegg,
yes.
I wanted to question Theresa May's judgment on appointing Fiona Wolf as the person to carry out this, you know, investigation into the her historic goings-on. Now, she previously appointed another lady who also, her appointment was questionable. you know, because she was related to the Attorney General of that time. Mm. Now, here we are again. She's appointing someone who knows this person, has been to dinner parties with him, well, in his company, and also sponsored his wife. Surely this person must resign. It's almost like me going on jury service, and I know the chappy down the road who's being accused on that day. Mm. How can this be possible that the government... It distinctly smells of cover-up.
Well, I don't entirely agree with you, Sheila. The Home Secretary made that decision, made that recommendation to myself and the Prime Minister, following a sort of exhaustive look at all the candidates. By the way, it's Fiona Wolf, obviously the chair, but the panel, I think there's a full panel of, I think, nine people. I haven't heard anything which suggests to me that the Home Secretary took the wrong decision.
So you're comfortable with this appointment?
Well, you know, I think Fiona Wolf is obviously a very credible person. Otherwise, the Home Secretary
would... she's not. I'm just asking if you're comfortable with this appointment.
Yeah, I don't think in and of itself, because...
So someone who's been around regularly, and I can use that word to dinner parties, someone who sponsored Leon Britton's wife on a fun run, and Leon Britton is at the heart of this, for certain allegations, you're comfortable with that?
All of which he strenuously denies. But
yes,
look...
But coming back to Fiona Wolf, you're comfortable with that.
Back to Fiona Wolf, I mean, as I say, the Home Secretary, the Home Office, particularly because, as you've rightly said, Sheila, the previous nominee did not, decided to withdraw... The Home Office did their due diligence, and they clearly don't feel that the reasons you've given somehow disqualify Fiona Wolf from the job. And I haven't heard anything yet which sort of suggests to me that the Home Secretary's in the wrong decision.
I'll try again. They were regular dinner parties at their houses. She sponsored his wife and their friends.
Yes, but look. No, remember,
I'm not impugning Fiona Wolf, but is that really the way to proceed?
Well, you are slightly.
I'm not. I'm sure she's a fantastic woman, but.
The suggestion is because she knows or even lives near somebody who, by the way, Fiona Wolf's panel is there to look at the whole issue of child abuse across the whole country, across time.
But there are allegations concerning Leon Britton, and she's friendly with his missus.
Well, there's this issue.
It wouldn't happen in the real world, would it?
There's this issue about the file that, while he was Home Secretary, was given to the Home Office. He's provided explanations, so on. I just think you've got to have confidence in the way in which the Home Secretary and her team scrutinised the panel members and Fiona Wolf and made the recommendation they did.
Let's get Sheila back into it. The great British public. Sheila, what do you say? We've locked horns on this one.
No, she should resign, and Theresa May's position is very questionable. This lady has made blunder after blunder from the borders, it's endless, and it's time she went, and this lady should not, she's attached to the establishment, so she should not be going ahead with it.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Let's respond to a little of what we heard from UKIP leader Nigel Farage, particularly regarding this rebate that the British government's been asked, £1.7 billion. I did point out to Nigel Farage, we'll play that in just a moment, we've got a senior economist hanging on the line, I want to get to her as soon as possible, but I did point out that in 2012, the year before last, we actually enjoyed a rebate of £3.2 billion. So, if you would pardon the expression, it is swings and roundabouts. Sometimes we get it back, sometimes we have to give it out, but how do you feel about it, particularly in these tough economic times? That leads me neatly to Vicky Price, Chief Economic Advisor at the Centre for Economics and Business Research. What should David Cameron and the British government do, Vicky Price? Morning.
Well, they're going to have to pay it. I don't think there's any way of getting out of it. It's inevitable that it would have happened because, of course, we've had a revaluation of our GDP overall, how you calculate how big we are as an economy, and also how you calculate how fast we've grown. We've followed EU rules in terms of recalculating all that. Some countries seem to have done worse, like France. We seem to have done a bit better, which is good news. And I think there is a spirit in Europe, there should be, of the richer countries paying a little bit more for the poor. A lot of that money goes to ensure that Europe does better in the future, which is very good news for us because we do want it to grow so that we can export goods to them.
The trouble is, all of the above makes sense, Vicky Price, if we really were in the good times. But is it fair to say we're still just baby steps towards an economic recovery?
I think that's true. I think, obviously, Cameron's going to find it difficult to justify it. Nevertheless, we are doing better than many other countries, and we've been very proud of the fact that we've done better. And I think, in a way, if you're part of a union, you've got to play your part.
OK. David Cameron, as you will be aware, seeking alliance with the Dutch Premier and others to resist this. The way you say it, is just, using the expression, spinning his wheels.
I'm afraid so, and I think it's a very difficult position for him because, of course, he's promising to do all sorts of things to renegotiate our position within Europe, particularly in terms of migration and other areas. The fact that he's very unlikely to get anywhere in this case suggests that it's going to be very, very difficult for him to come back to the country with anything serious in terms of being able to achieve what he really would like to achieve before the next election.
How do you respond to the idea being put out by some Conservative MPs that this is payback for Cameron talking tough about immigration matters?
I don't think there's anything in there at all. I think it's very statistically based, very boringly economically based, I'm afraid, in this case. It's got very little to do with politics itself.
OK. And lastly, the timing is unfortunate. David Cameron, I would imagine you're a pro-European, Vicky Price. David Cameron, yes, and others under a lot of pressure, Britain's relationship in Europe. It really couldn't have come at a worse time for the PM.
But absolutely not. We have a sort of by-election happening in a few weeks' time, and that's going to be a real worry. And, of course, UKIP is upping quite considerably the noise it's making about Europe, and that isn't going to help at all in terms of how they stand with European polls in the by-election coming up.
All right, thank you for your time. I know you're between meetings. Vicky Price, Chief Economics Advisor at the Centre for Economics and Business Research. So there's another voice telling us why we may say can't pay, won't pay, but it looks like we're going to have to pay, and we've only got until December the 1st. Let's go back. It's important to hear a little of what Nigel Farage said on that. It was the open, unsurprisingly, it was the opening question. I think it was Herbie and Harrow who got it started. This was Mr Farage's reaction.
No doubt we'll hear some tough talk from Mr Cameron today. And he'll say he's going to battle
he's
them.
Trying to get an alliance going with the Dutch Premier, isn't he, Nigel Farage?
Yeah, but he's not going to get any support from the Germans, and the Germans rule Europe. It is a German-dominated Europe, and what Mrs Merkel says goes.
But if we've benefited, if Britain have benefited in the past from rebates, would it not be correct that this time, when we're doing rather well, we have to actually give more? If you look at 2012, I understand we got a rebate of £3.2 billion.
Well, yes.
So therefore,
our net contribution was still 8.6 billion sterling. That's over tuppence on income tax for everybody in this country.
But if we took it 2 years ago, because we weren't doing well, we took 3.2 billion 2 years ago. This year we are doing well. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with giving the 1.7 when you're doing well if you've been given 3.2 when you weren't doing so well?
Well, I tell you what, Nick, I've got a better idea than that. Why not pay nothing? Why not pay nothing? I'm quite happy to go on buying champagne or Mercedes motor cars or whatever it is we want to do, and we'll do business, and we'll go on holiday there, and we'll do student exchanges, and we'll be great mates, and that'll be wonderful. But what on earth do we have to pay a membership fee to a club who made 1,000 new laws for British businesses last year, and with whom we trade at a massive deficit? I wouldn't pay a penny.
Nigel Farage exclusively on LBC. 9:41, you're listening to LBC News breaking at this time. The UK economy grew by 0.7% during the third quarter of 2014. These figures arriving just a few moments ago. Indeed, playing into this conversation about the amount of money the UK may have to pay additionally. To give you that figure again, the UK economy growing by 0.7% during the third quarter of 2014. These are official statistics even from the Office for National Statistics, ONS. More, I'm sure, analysis on that with some of my colleagues throughout the course of the day. But there we are, the British economy continuing to do well as European economies shrink. We will hand, or rather Europe will hand over money to the Germans and to the French. Merci bien and recht vielen danke. Meanwhile, we've got to write a cheque for £1.7 billion. Sherry is in Hackney. How do you react, Sherry?
Hi, this is my first time calling.
Hello.
Hi. I'm a second, third generation immigrant in this country. I was born in East London. My children have grown up. I was brought up in a single-parent family. I brought my children up, single-parent, home-educated them. Unfortunately, their father wasn't particularly good. Was failed in that sense when I hunted them down and the services of TSA would not take
right.
him. So, like I said, I've home-educated my children. The eldest two are full-time employment. We're all in private accommodation, trying desperately to save for deposit. This government and this country is absolutely in all of my 44 years has failed me and my children
How?
Miserably.
How?
In terms of education, they couldn't provide my children with an education as decent as the one I had back in the 70s. I was in Newham, and that's where they were schooled. Constant problems with children in the classroom, abusing teachers, throwing chairs at teachers, smoking marijuana outside the classrooms. In the end, I just had to pull them out and home educate them. My youngest daughter is 12 now. She was reading fluently by three, and she's doing extremely well in school.
How does this play into our conversation about Europe?
This plays in because if this government is so intent on doing for the immigrants and Europe as a whole, and it wants, but it's doing nothing for the people of this country. I live in a borough now. I'm not going to say which borough. I know you said Hackney. I moved out of Newham due to extreme racism. My grandfather was a Pakistani Muslim. I'll just put that in there.
Right.
We suffered serious amount. We were spat at. The names that we were called, I couldn't repeat.
No, thank you. Yeah.
The borough that I'm in now, I'm having exactly the same problem. There has actually been a case.
But this is awful. But how is this Europe's fault?
Because it's the way this government has gone. When Labour came in, they suppressed so much for people to be able to say something, to be able to fight for something, to fight for the same rights of an immigrant. And we've just been so suppressed because if we dare to say anything, we're classed as racist.
Mm.
Like I say, I'm second, third generation immigrant myself. My youngest daughter is a foreign national. Mm. And still now, like I say, there's a case opened up amongst the local police station because of the abuse that we've suffered.
It sounds absolutely horrific. Only for time reasons, Sherry, please do stay in touch. I do want to hear about the issues that you're enduring. I don't know that it's necessarily wholly pertaining to this conversation about Europe, but we will talk again, and thank you for being a first-time caller. I look forward to our second conversation. Let's get some of the emails, tweets and texts that are coming. I didn't say it. I know you all think it didn't come out as badly as you were hoping. I just stopped short of saying it. Emails, texts and tweets. Thank goodness there wasn't a fax in there. Where might that have gone? Malcolm in Maidenhead. It's hard to believe Nigel Farage really is a politician. This is because he actually answers questions he's asked, as opposed to saying things such as, well, the real question is, a breath of fresh air, exclamation mark. Patsy. Whatever your views, you cannot deny this man's attraction. He actually answers questions. He's very persuasive and talks a lot of sense. And you say, do I remember meeting you? Yes, I do. It was at Anthony's party at the Groucho, wasn't it, a few weeks ago? Gordon Wundless. Nigel Farage and experts on Europe and able to sort that out. Please ask him to explain how banking works. Again, he's the only politician who understands that banks do not create wealth. Seems to be universal support. If you don't like him, by the way, you know how to get in touch. You can email, text or tweet, or give me a call. Don't know the number. 118, I've got it. David's in Tooting. You're on the radio. Hi, David.
Yeah, morning, Nick.
Hello,
morning.
Buddy.
This is a great opportunity for David Cameron to guarantee he'll win the next election. All he's got to do is say to the EU, OK, you want £1.7 billion from us, sue us. And if you've ever tried to sue somebody, you'll know, Nick, how long it can take. And
it's taken
way past the election. He'd be cheered to the echo if he's got the cojones to do it.
Well,
I think a guarantee will win.
Here's the thing. Undeniably, 2 years ago, when we were in dire straits, they gave us a £3.2 billion rebate, right? Now we're doing well. They say, well, actually, we need 1.7 extra. If you've signed up to that and you've benefited from it in the past, it's not necessarily the British way to turn your back on it when you don't like the way the deal is going.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. Leading Britain's conversation, Larry Lamb on LBC.
Trying to get a new start when you serve time in prison is not easy. Seemingly, a lot of potential employers are very wary of employing ex-offenders. How can they be encouraged to think differently?
My fiancé is a reformed criminal. I do think people absolutely deserve a second chance. I think, if anything, my partner values the life he has now so much and works so hard to make sure that
nothing jeopardises that.
That's it. Staying on the straight and narrow, right?
Definitely.
The one and only Larry Lamb. Sunday morning from 11, only on LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Let's do some email questions. Thank you for your call there. This comes in from Elizabeth in Leicestershire. Do you think it's possible David Cameron will simply refuse to pay by December the 1st and, sorry about this last part, and actually grow a pair? Sorry about that.
Elizabeth, whether it's this money or whether it's the question of open borders to everybody from Southern and Eastern Europe, the point is this. We signed up to a treaty. Over 40 years ago, we signed up to a treaty that's been subsequently amended. The last amendment was the Lisbon Treaty, the one that Mr Cameron said he'd give us a referendum on and then changed his mind. We are a law-abiding nation. All the while we're members of the club, we will abide by the rules. And that's why my suggestion is that we have a different relationship, not based on politics, but based simply on trade. So the answer is, he will pay up.
Graham in Bushy, why have you formed alliances and pacts with far right-wing parties, some of whom are Holocaust deniers and have questionable beliefs? That was something that Nick Clegg alluded to yesterday.
Let me be clear about one thing. Everything in Europe is a compromise. You're dealing with different countries and different cultures. You know, the Labour Party sit with a Croatian party who are openly and aggressively homophobic. The Greens sat in the last European Parliament, led by a man who actually endorsed sexual relations with underage children. The Conservative Party...
Does it make it right, Mr Farage?
Hang on a second. I will deal with this, don't worry.
Okay.
And the Conservatives have got one of their members who's got a conviction for racism. So all across the Parliament, you get these strange alliances. My position is this. We won the European elections with the biggest UK party there, and I want our voters to have a voice in that place. That's why they sent us there. If I'm not in a group, if we're not part of a group, we won't get the speaking time. I wouldn't have got the chance, as I did this week, face-to-face with Mr Barroso and Mr Juncker, you know, make some UKIP arguments. So I needed to form a compromise, which I did with one MP, not with a party, but with one MEP from a Polish party that, you're quite right, you know, is not the kind of party that espouses the views that UKIP has. I will do what I can to keep UKIP's voice in that parliament, but not at any price. So I've made it absolutely clear.
Why did it have to be Robert Ivasevich, though?
Because there was nobody else.
Who says it, domestic violence would help bring wives back to earth.
Well, he did actually say that he was making that point.
The leader of the party says...
Oh, no. The leader of the party. I would not sit in the European Parliament with the leader of that party. I've made it clear. We won't sit with the French National Front. I've made it absolutely clear. So what I've done here, Nick, it's a compromise.
You don't do compromise, Mr. Farage.
Well, I could have not done this deal, and we would then have 24 UKIP MEPs effectively without a voice, and 4.5 million voters effectively without a voice. It is a very difficult
position.
Do you
want to do a deal with someone you have to hold your nose every time you sit with them?
No, and as I said to you, I will not do this at any price. You know, if we faced a situation...
There was no one else, Mr. Farage?
No.
It was the best of the bunch.
It's a very... I can assure you there's far worse than that in the European Parliament, and that's one of the things, of course, that's happened, particularly with the Eurozone crisis, is we've got people like Golden Dawn, a political party from Greece, who, you know, are an avowedly neo-Nazi party. So this is difficult stuff. Whether this group holds together or not, we'll have to see. I am looking to try and get more people to join the group. Either it holds, and we keep our speaking time. If it doesn't, then UKIP will be, I'm afraid, put into obscurity.
But just lastly, the leader of this particular group, I appreciate not the man you know. I mean, he's reprehensible, isn't he?
Oh, utterly. And I will not be sitting with him. If the choice, Nick, if the choice is sitting with that guy or obscurity, I'll choose obscurity.
All right. OK, one last email before we go back to the calls. This comes in from Simon in Kent. Does Nigel Farage think footballers are role models, and should the man from Sheffield United get play professional football again? I'm sure you don't need reminding of
that. No, I don't. Are they role models? Goodness me, they're just about the biggest role models for our youngsters that there is. I mean, football, in my lifetime, football's got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It is mega. I'm afraid, young people, too much money, you know, things are bound to go wrong. But do I think this man should be allowed to play professional football again? No, I don't, actually. I don't. Now, let's move on, and our next caller is David in Darlington. Good morning.
Darlington? No, I'm in Leicester.
Are you?
Sorry, my fault. That's down to me. Totally down to me. David in Leicester. The home of great football, by the way. David in Leicester. Go ahead, sir.
I'm not a fan of football, so...
All right. Okay. This is getting worse, this call, isn't it?
I wish I hadn't said it now, Nigel.
Go on, David, go for
it. When you're in a hole, stop.
Nigel, I'm not a member of the BNP, but why is it you don't allow BNP ex-members into your party? Given what you've just said, you're in coalition with these Polish far-right, the Polish far-right group.
I repeat, I'm not in coalition with the Polish far-right group.
All right, well,
I've done a deal with one individual MP on whose record I could not find a single anti-Jewish comment or anything of that kind.
White beating,
right. The British National Party, I'm afraid, was led and dominated for many years by a group of people who genuinely were unsavoury. You know, only had a look at people with convictions for arson and stabbing and goodness
knows... But that doesn't implicate everyone in the party.
David, you are absolutely right. I agree with you. And
people
possibly...
People have been in the Labour Party who are now in your party. People are in the Conservative Party who are now in your party. Labour Party are more left-wing than any other group I know.
David...
They're all ex-communists, the leadership of the Labour Party.
Why don't you allow BNP members?
Let's hear Mr. Farage.
I do understand what you're saying, because former BNP members are welcome to join the Conservative or Labour Party, and indeed, Labour have some councillors in the north of England who previously were BNP councillors. I have done everything I can to make sure that UKIP is a genuinely non-racist, non-sectarian political party. And from that platform, we can make the big arguments about what needs to be done to make this a better country. If we open the doors, as the others do, to former BNP members, we probably would get some people joining who were genuinely decent people, who joined the BNP at the time because they thought it was the only possible protest. But we would also get some people who, frankly, would drag our party into the mire. And that is why I've put the ban on. And if that is seen to be a bit unfair, I'm sorry, but I've done it in the interests of getting back control of our country.
Quick response from you, David.
You had a candidate, Anne-Marie Crampton, who said World War II was engineered by Zionists and bankers to create the state of Israel. She was never in the BNP, but she has similar views to the leadership of the BNP. So why did you allow her into your party?
Oh, well, you know, there are 40,000 of them. I haven't actually, you know, mind tested every single one of them. I've no doubt there are people in UKIP that say things, as there are people of other parties that say things that we wouldn't necessarily like or choose. David, I get your point. You think I'm being too harsh and unfair, but I've done it for a reason, and that isn't going to change. That's my decision.
Thanks for your call, David. Where do we go, Mr. Farage?
We go to South Wales, and we speak to Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning, Nigel. Thanks for taking my call. Nigel, with the forthcoming elections, how can we stop the postal ballot fraud?
Oh.
I stood in South Wales, and I was refused to go in to canvass pensioners in their complexes, and being told that the Labour had sorted things out. How can we sort out the postal ballot fraud?
How big a problem is this, Mr. Farage?
I am so pleased, Jeff, that you asked me that question. It is abhorrent. Tony Blair changed the law in 2000. The idea was that you made postal voting easier, more people would vote. And for the first 7 years of the postal voter registration scheme, you didn't even have to prove your identity to get a postal vote.
Now, good grief.
Oh, no, I'm being serious. Now, one or two independent journalists have been to Tower Hamlets. Mm. All right? Where, you know, one-bedroom flats with 12 names on the electoral roll. A lot of that's gone on. The other thing, Jeff, with postal voting is... So, firstly, there's the fraud element. Secondly, there's the element where by-elections, in particular, can be reduced to nonsenses. I'll give you an example. The Labour MP for South West Manchester, a place called Withenshaw, died in the new year. Mr. Goggins died on New Year's Day, out jogging. There was a by-election. Nominations closed on the 29th of January, and the postal votes arrived on the 1st of February. No time for anybody else to get involved. And the turnout in some of these by-elections, over 50% of the vote, are postal votes. And this is how it works. So the postman goes down the street and delivers a postal vote letter, you know, to Mrs. Smith in number 83. Mrs. Smith is, you know, an elderly lady on a stick, and half an hour later, there's a knock on the door from a canvasser from the party that originally signed her up to the postal vote to say, "Hello, Mrs. Smith, can I collect your postal vote now?" What choice has she got? And I put it to you,
that's
Jeff.
That's illegal, isn't it?
No, it is only illegal if the canvasser touches the ballot paper. But if the 6'4" canvasser stands over Mrs. Smith and makes sure she fills in her postal vote, that is not illegal. And so we've now got to a position where, frankly, postal voting is leading not just to fraud, but to intimidation. Mm. And Jeff, one of my campaigns, I want the entire postal voting system scrapped. And I want to go back...
Well, hang on, what about elderly...
I want to go back to the concept... I want to go back to the concept that you get a postal vote if you're in the army, you work overseas, or you're elderly, or you're infirm. Let's go back to postal voting being genuinely what it was for, not now the mass abuse that we've got. All right? And that's one of the things, Jeff, I feel very strongly about. The Electoral Commission, who've been in place now for 14 years, have utterly failed in every job.
Jeff, could I just say something?
Response. Go on, yeah. Jeff.
I wrote the Electoral Commission to say that the Labour people were filling in the ballot forms, taking them back to the local council, and they said, "Oh, we're happy with that." And I thought, how can they say that?
Well,
terrible.
Well, I'm afraid the Electoral Commission is not working. And to think that this country now has a voting system that is in doubt, I think is a really bad indictment of modern Britain. Let's make it better. Thank you for that.
Thanks,
okay,
Jeff. Where do we
go? Moving on to Christian in Northolt. Good morning.
Good morning, Nigel. My name's Christian. I'm a Romanian coach driver working in London. I got a few questions for you. Do you know how many people live in Romania?
Let's work it out. Romania and Bulgaria, between them, 27.5 million.
Yes, so why did you say there's 29 million Romanians and Bulgarians coming here?
Well, there were 29 million Romanians and Bulgarians, but 1.5 million of them have left in the last 10 years. In fact, there's 1 million of them living and working in Italy. And what I said was this. Let's be clear, Christian, what I said. I said we're opening our doors to 29 million people from Romania and Bulgaria.
You're not. There's not even 29 million in both countries.
Well, there were.
Let's leave that aside.
Actually, Christian,
I really rather under-egged it. What I should have said is, we now have an open door to 485 million people. There are 485 million people now who have the equivalent of my British passport. They are all welcome.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.